Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Well, we live in an age where news is instant, downloadable, breaking, and 24/7. But when it comes to news, do you believe everything you read, see, and hear? And indeed, should you? Well, our next guest says you have good reason not to. And he's worked as a hardened hack for many years. He's seen firsthand the practices of some of Britain's most respected broadsheets. Nick Davies is author of a book called Flat Earth News, and he joins us on the line from the UK. Welcome to Open House, Nick.
Hi.
When I think of the best of journalism, I guess you think of, say, the big scoops, maybe like the Watergate scandal, where two journalists, Woodward and Bernstein of the Washington Post, brought down a president, Richard Nixon. I guess thinking of that as perhaps a benchmark, how has journalism changed since those years?
Well, it's changed a lot. In fact, it was that story, Watergate, that made me want to become a journalist all those many years ago. Mm. The big thing that's happened is that ownership of the media has moved from the old family firms into the hands of big corporations. And those corporations have done what corporations always like to do, which is to improve their profit ratio. So they've tended to cut our editorial staff, but at the same time they've increased our output. So radio and television goes 24 hours a day and newspapers have all these extra supplements. And the result of that is, very simply, we no longer have the time to do our job properly. We did a huge piece of number crunching and found that on average, reporters in Fleet Street on the national newspapers in Britain have only a third of the time to work on each story compared to what they used to have in the mid-1980s. Hmm. And if you follow this through, these big corporations have also affected in all sorts of really rather subtle ways the way in which reporters approach their stories, the stories we choose to do, the angles we take. And really what's happening is that it's the logic of commerce moving in and overwhelming the logic of journalism. And it's corrupted our profession.
You did some very interesting research with Cardiff University, and I see that you were analysing domestic print stories in Britain over a two-week period, and it found that 60% of the stories that made it into print were from either wire copy or PR material. 20% contained clear evidence of wire copy and PR material, and just a skimpy 12% of stories were generated from the reporters themselves. I guess to some degree that must have shocked you. On the other hand, it probably just gave a few figures behind what you've been feeling for a while is happening anyway.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So that research confirms and quantifies what I was afraid was happening, which is that instead of being active news gatherers going out there and making contacts and finding stories and checking facts, we've become, by and large, with some exceptions, passive processors of second-hand material. And this second-hand material tends to come from two sources. It comes off the news agencies like AP and Reuters, and it comes from the public relations industry. And both of those sources are inherently unreliable. With the best will in the world, you see, news agencies don't actually know what's going on their patch. They have very small staffs and very limited resources. And PR material is always produced in the interests of whatever organization is paying for it. Mm. And once we as a news organization start to reproduce that stuff, we're then betraying our basic function, because we should be working in the interests of our readers or viewers or listeners. You see, if you pull back and look at the really big falsehoods that we've run in the media, like the weapons of mass destruction, which is probably the defining story of our era, and we got it fundamentally wrong in media outlets all around the planet, that's what's going on there. It isn't that we journalists are corruptly taking bribes from government or intelligence agencies to tell people lies. In the first place, we genuinely have no idea what we're talking about. Right? We don't tell you the truth because we don't know what it is. Mm. And as a substitute, we recycle this second-hand material that government PR people or intelligence agency PR people are feeding out to wire agencies. It comes into our newsrooms. We haven't got the time to check it. We just bang it out. And so we've become fundamentally vulnerable to being manipulated in this way.
Nick, have you done any research into the weapons of mass destruction era then, and what was going on in newsrooms at the time? I mean, with all the various news agencies globally that would have been interested in that story, there was nobody that had the time to really chase the facts?
As far as I know, that's correct. It's startling, isn't it? Because that's huge story.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, for example, there was an analysis of output produced by the BBC in the build-up to the invasion of Iraq. And the BBC has a culture of honesty. It doesn't have some evil owner leaning on, down on, from on high and telling them what to write. And that found that 86% of the stories they put out simply took it for granted that those weapons of mass destruction existed. Hmm. So, I mean, in the UK, I got myself into rather a lot of trouble, actually, because journalists, by and large, have a kind of unwritten rule that they don't write about other journalists. So I decided to break that rule and went inside various newsrooms to analyse the way in which they were producing falsehood and distortion and propaganda. And in the case of the WMD, I looked at The Observer, which is a very prestigious, historically left-of-centre Sunday newspaper, which had produced hugely false stories. I mean, great big double-page spreads, which said that Saddam Hussein was responsible for the terrorist attacks of September 2001. Or that Saddam was responsible for the anthrax letters which were distributed in the United States after those terrorist attacks. And, I mean, and more false stories. And when it comes, when I actually got inside the newsroom and found out how that had happened, it really is a model of manipulation that you had on the one hand intelligence agencies like the British MI6 and the American CIA providing off-the-record briefings to one particular journalist, who was then recycling this stuff into print in The Observer. And then on the other hand, you had Tony Blair's staff at Downing Street manipulating the then political editor of The Observer, who again was recycling his briefings into print. And the result was not just that Observer readers were misled on a grand scale, but also that the leadership of the paper itself was misled, so that they were believing the false stories that they were publishing. And one of the saddest outcomes of that was that other journalists who were filing accurate stories, which questioned the existence of the weapons of mass destruction, didn't get those stories published because the misled editors assumed that those stories must be wrong.
Okay, yeah.
So the whole newspaper was flipped over on its head.
Dear me. This is Open House. We're talking to journalist Nick Davies. He's written this book called Flat Earth News. So, I mean, you're raising some pretty concerning issues then when it comes to the average newsroom, particularly for your own country, Britain, but I...
Actually, like I said, it isn't just Britain. This is all across the developed world. You'll see the same pattern of big corporations taking over newspapers and ruining them. Because, in fact, a few years ago, about 1995, I worked for a while on the Melbourne Age, and I had a great time, and I worked with very good people. But that newspaper was well on its way to being ruined by the same sort of forces that you see at work in Britain. And, I mean, I would think that this is affecting just about every newspaper in the developed world. And I am speaking from 10 years ago, so who knows, maybe it's been rescued since. But these fixtures and forces that are slowly strangling the news media and making them no longer a generally reliable source of information, those fixtures and forces are at work all over the developed world.
Mm. The Millennium Bug story of late 1999, you've done a bit of background checking into that one too?
That's almost comical to look back on, but quite instructive too. You see, there was a grain of truth at the bottom of all that, which was that people who really understood computers were saying something could go wrong on Millennium Eve, but they didn't know quite what would go wrong. They didn't know the scale, i.e. how many computers would be affected, and they didn't know the seriousness, whether this would simply be a question of, oh, I don't know, writing letters with the year 1900 instead of the year 2000 written on them. So nobody was quite sure of the truth, but that doesn't stop news organizations from running stories and from being manipulated by all kinds of people who started to jump on this Millennium Bug bandwagon, whether it was estate agents trying to sell houses in remote places to which people could flee to get away from the Millennium chaos.
I didn't know about that.
people selling kits that were supposed to protect your computer from the terrifying Millennium Bug. Yeah. And we're there in the background in the media. We were running stories saying that NATO nuclear-headed rockets might fire themselves into space on Millennium Eve, that prison doors would fly open and all the bad guys would run out into
the
street.
Remember that, yeah.
It was completely crazed, and yet very instructive, because, as I mentioned a moment ago, if you ask why don't the news media tell the truth, the simple, basic answer is because we don't know what it is, right? And then we're off with all this strange commercialized logic that's taken over. I mean, so one very simple example of that is if a story will sell newspapers, we're going to bang it out there. even if it isn't true. I mean, I think everybody understands that, that's how we've become commercialized. But there are, you know, numerous other rather subtle ways in which it goes on.
Mm. So, Nick, what's the answer? I mean, the fact is, though, that, I mean, at the same time, newspapers and media organizations still need to stay afloat. And so, you know, sometimes costs need to be cut. And what's the answer?
Well, I'm not entirely sure what the answer is. I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. So clearly there is the possibility of an answer somewhere out there on the internet. Because if this is basically about not having enough money to be able to do our job properly, you can see that if we start to produce newspapers which are published electronically, i.e. on websites, we can save a huge amount of money. We no longer have to print the wretched things. We no longer have to pay to distribute them. So there are huge savings. But what isn't clear is how we earn money out of these electronic newspapers, because it's a strange thing that for many generations, people have been willing to put their hand in their pocket and take out money to pay for a hard copy version of the news. But when they look at it on a website, they expect to get it for free. So we're not earning money. Like the newspaper I work for in Britain, The Guardian, has 18.5 million unique users hitting its website every month. And all of them get all of that news for free. We're not earning anything off it. So all we do is earn a little bit from putting advertising on the website. But what isn't clear, what really nobody knows, is whether that advertising revenue can grow to the point at which it would be able to pay for the huge editorial operation that's needed to produce reliable news. And then the other way in which the web may help is the idea of citizen journalism. But in fact, you don't need specialist reporters. That the great mass of punters out there will themselves observe what's going on and take photographs and file blogs, and therefore collectively we'll be able to discover what's going on in the world.
That itself is inherently fraught with danger, though, isn't it? Inherently fraught.
Well, exactly, because there's so much nonsense out there on the web, and how are we as consumers supposed to distinguish between what's reliable and what isn't? And people collectively believe all sorts of things which prove to be false. There's an interesting new word that's been coined, actually. Have you come across this wikiality? You know, like Wikipedia, which is put together by a consensus of different contributors. And wikiality simply says, well, never mind what reality is. If most of us believe that the following is true, well, then we'll decide that it is true. And you can see a world in which wikiality would take over from reality. Yeah. And that's quite frightening. But so I don't want to say that the internet doesn't somehow provide us with a solution, but if it does, then at this moment it isn't quite clear how it does it.
One of the really, really scary things about this is the fact that we really can't, as readers, as consumers of news, we really can't tell how much those facts have actually been checked behind a particular story, if, as you say, really because there's so little money and therefore so little time given to and then provided for journalists to actually chase up a real story rather than simply just take it from some sort of PR script. Are there any ways for us to really know what we read and whether we can discern whether it's really true?
It's tricky. I mean, the best thing that readers can do is to become highly skeptical and, in a sense, highly skilled at decoding the way that newspapers or news bulletins on television and radio are put together. Because I think that once you understand the way that a newsroom works, you can quite easily spot the PR, spot the propaganda, spot the wire copy, and learn to kind of discard it, or at least put it in its place.
If there was some sort of a central website where every piece of PR actually was placed, then that would be some sort of repository that then, I guess, news stories could be judged against, maybe.
What I would really love to be able to do is to set up a shadow newsroom that would monitor the output of all national media outlets and produce a rolling, say, three-month percentage to reflect the proportion of that outlet's stories which had proved to be false or distorted. And then what I'd like is a law that requires media product to be labelled in the same way as food products are, so that you know what's inside it. So the result of this would be that you turn on the radio and the newsreader would say, good afternoon, welcome to the 2 o'clock news. 47% of our stories have proved to be false or distorted over the last 3 months, and here we go again. And there it would be. On the front page of The Guardian, it would say, X percent of our stories have been false or distorted, and the same with the Sydney Morning Herald and the Melbourne Age and all the rest of them. And
You're going to be so popular in Britain, I can tell you.
But you see, that would hit those big corporations in their most sensitive part, which is their wallet, because consumers would start to walk away if they understood quite what proportion of the news is false and distorted. But the trouble is that I can't see any of that happening in the